today I finish what I want to say about the free field, and basically that's going to be discussing how you can derive the Wieck theorem, celebrated Wieck theorem, using functional integral. Well, the derivation is quite easy, and I think some of them have seen it already. And then I'm going to start the discussion of how to quantize the interacting QFT on the simplest example that we can deal with using what I've been treating so far, which is a scalar field, but an interacting scalar field. So I'm going to introduce what's called the lambda phi to the 4 theory, where phi is still a scalar field. But that's going to need several lectures. Okay, so first, the Wieck theorem. So I'm going to, I'll see how you can derive Wieck theorem introducing functional integral. But in fact, I think someone mentioned in the last lecture this concept already. I'm going to use the concept of generating functional, which is something that will be very important in discussing the phi-4 theory, and that allows to show very quickly the Wieck theorem. So let's go back to the theory. I'm considering the free field, so with an action which is S of phi equal integral d dx 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus n squared over 2 phi squared. The following, I mean, omit the E for Euclidean subscript here. So I'm going to derive everything in the Euclidean theory, but once you have that, you can easily derive the same result for the theory at real time. Okay, it makes things a bit simple. So we have the Euclidean action for an Euclidean field. X is just a vector in position space, RD. And Wieck theorem states how we can compute vacuum expectation value of products of operators that correspond to phi operator, phi variable in phi, but not only two, but products of them. So in order to see that, a convenient object is to introduce a generating function. So let's consider the generic functional integral. That's the kind of object you have to deal with, and let's call it Z. Okay. And there is a 1 over h bar. Okay. And let's add to this what's called the source term, which is going to be, and if I'm not mistaken, minus G dot phi. I'm going to explain what this means. So now I have a function of an object which I call G. And what does this mean? So G is a classical function. So it's a function on space. So it's given by G of X. Okay, and g phi means simply integral over d dx of g of x phi of x. Okay. So I change the action by adding a linear term in phi, which depends on x. And so this big functional integral becomes a function of the function g. So it's a functional of g. Okay? And so g is a classical function, but it's all, often it's called a source term. Source term. Because it's going to be the source of the generating functions. Okay? And and an important difference is that G is classical, it's a classical field, while phi is a quantum field, it's a random variable. So G is classical, remember, phi is quantum. In the language of functional integral, it means that phi is a random variable. And you integrate over this random variable in the functional integral. Okay, so why is this object important? This object is important because by taking functional derivative of z, you get correlation function. See? Because if you consider this object and consider functional derivative, and I assume you are a bit familiar with functional derivative. I think you have seen that in the front end already. So functional derivative means that you take derivative with respect to the value of g, g at a given point, x. So you define delta over delta g of x as modifying g by g plus some small variation and keeping the linear term in the variation. And you see that when you do this in this big object, you are taking the variation with respect to g of exponential of 1 over h bar g phi. So minus and the minus. So basically, of course, there are two parentheses. Basically, this makes 1 over an h bar minus 1 phi of x. H bar minus 1 phi of x drops out from the exponential from c.
Is there a minus sign?
What?
A minus sign?
The minus, there is a minus sign here and a minus sign. So they cancel. That's why we choose this g. Okay? And basically, this means that if you take n functional derivative, so if you consider now delta of delta g of x1 times delta of delta g of xn with n, so arbitrary number, out of z of g, then you get h bar phi of x1, h bar, well, h bar minus 1, phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of xn. Okay? Inside this. So what you get is, well, you get the factor h bar minus n, which is important at that stage. And then you get inside the functional integral, phi of x1 up to phi of xn. But of course, it's inside the functional integral, so you have integrate over that. And in fact, let's consider this, but divide this by g of x, by z of x, z of g, sorry, z of g. So you take the functional derivative of this acting on this object, you divide by the object you have not. So the functional derivative applies only on this term, on the numerator. Then you divide z of g. Then you get a functional integral with phi of x1, phi of xn inserted here. And you divide with the functional integral without phi. So what you get is the expectation value in the free theory of this object, of this product of random variable,
But still,
yes.
To get expectation value, I need to.
Pardon?
To get expectation value, don't I need to evaluate your ecosystem?
Yes, of course. That's what I'm going to say. Thank you. You are faster than me. Yes, of course. Then you have to set g equals zero. Otherwise, you still have the action s of phi minus g of phi, which is perfectly legitimate. But okay. So taking functional derivative of the generating function, normalizing it by the original one, setting at the end g equals zero, gives you the correlation functions of the theory. This is the correlation function. And this works out for an arbitrary number of derivatives, or an arbitrary number of products of fields. And this should correspond in the theory at real time at, well, the standard vacuum expectation value of time order products of phi hat of x1, phi hat of xn, where now these are the field operator in the canonical formalism, going from Euclidean to Minkowski, you recover. So this is going to be the same object that this vacuum expectation value of products of operator in the quantum theory formulated in terms of states and operators. Okay. Yes?
Why are we guaranteed that the result, so when we do a weak rotation back to the Minkowski theory, that the resulting expectation value is a time order product? Because in this, when we go to Euclidean time, the time ordering seems unimportant.
No, but we have seen that doing that you automatically get the time order product.
I mean, I understand that in the Minkowski context, right?
Yes.
But when we go to Euclidean time, it's not, I guess it's just not obvious to me that the time ordering is.
Well, in fact, as in Minkowski theory, in Euclidean space, time ordering is automatic. Because when you consider, if you consider a theory, well, I can draw a picture. I think there is a picture in my book. Consider that the Euclidean theory, you have seen that, for instance, you know, this is a picture where here I represent real time and here I represent Euclidean time. Okay, and I'd like to represent it on a cylinder because remember, it's better to consider the theory at Euclidean theory in a periodic Euclidean time and then let the period goes to infinity. Here you are on safe ground. Okay, so you can view the complex time space as a cylinder, infinite in the real dimension, periodic in the imaginary dimension. So this is a complex time cylinder. Okay? So when you are doing a path integral in Euclidean time, you are considering just exponential where phi is defined on this line, which of course goes back to the origin. Okay? And then when you are defining a path integral in Euclidean time, if you insert operators, you have a time t1, you have an Euclidean time tau1, let's call it tau, and real time is t. So I have tau1, tau, tau2, etc. And when doing that, of course, you have first to do your path integral from the origin to t tau 1, then from tau 1 to tau 2, then from tau 2 to tau, 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 and back to the period. Because we have seen that exponential of minus tau over h bar times the Hamiltonian is defined only if tau is positive. So you cannot go back in time, in Euclidean time. That's forbidden. So you see that here again, you must have, if you have that tau 1 is less than tau 2, less than the period. Okay? And now if you make a Vick rotation, it means that you deform this contour of integration to go back here. So you get a T1 and a T2, and they are automatically time order. So that's the same. So that was a question about time ordering in real and Euclidean time variable. Okay, so let's go back to this. So if we know how to compute this z of g, we know all the correlation function of the field. So now the point is that this can be computed easily in the free field theory, because the action is quadratic. So this is still a Gaussian integration. So how to compute this? How do we compute this for the free theory? Well, we write S of phi as the action that I wrote here. I can rewrite it in a more compact way as 1/2 of a quadratic form, which is phi times minus the Laplacian applied to phi. That's just I integrate by part, and I rewrite integral over dx of minus phi times the Laplacian of phi plus phi as this plus m squared. And I can write this minus Laplacian plus m squared applied to phi. So that's just a compact notation for this. It's just a compact notation to write integral over 1/2 of integral over d dx phi of x times minus the Laplacian of phi of x plus m squared phi of x. Just a compact notation. When I have a dot product here, it means integral over x of the product of the two functions. So the dot is just dot equal scalar product of functions in space, in RD. Yes?
The second line is a minus m squared or a plus?
There is a minus here. Yes. The minus is just because if you integrate by parts, integral d dx of d mu phi is integral d dx of d mu of phi d mu phi, which is the total derivative, which is zero if you have periodic boundary condition, minus integral d dx of phi d mu phi, which is the Laplacian operator, hence the minus sign. Yes?
I think the question was maybe with the problem with the minus m, there is minus m squared in the first line, plus minus m squared.
Ah, I'm sorry. I thought you speak about this phi, but indeed, yes, I'm sorry, there is a typo. Yeah, sorry, excuse me. I didn't notice the typo. Thank you very much. Okay, so we can rewrite the action as a quadratic form in phi. And therefore, we are getting a functional integral over the exponential of a quadratic form. Now, in order to solve that, it's easy. We make a change of variable in phi. So we have an exponential which is 1/2 of phi times minus lambda plus m, minus delta plus m squared times phi minus g phi. So complete the square by 1/2 of g times the inverse of this times g, and then subtract the term. So this equals this. And of course, this is nothing but 1/2 of phi prime or phi tilde, let's say. Phi tilde minus 1/2 of g minus delta plus m squared minus 1 times g with phi tilde equal phi minus g minus delta plus m squared times g. Formal manipulation, but I make just a change variable. And this is just a linear shift. In phi, it's independent of the value of phi. G is a constant. G is a fixed function, which means that I can change the variables. I can write the integral over phi tilde instead of the integral over phi.
Sorry, are you solving for the
expansion? No, that's in the action. So I can rewrite my functional integral as integral over d of phi tilde times exponential of minus just the ordinary action for phi tilde minus 1 over h bar phi tilde minus delta plus m squared times phi tilde, these terms. And these terms is independent of phi, so I can get it out. And then I get it out. And so I have a minus 1 over h bar, minus 1/2. So I get 1 over 2. Well, I get h bar over 2, g times minus delta plus m squared times g. And this drops out of the functional integral. So this is something which is independent of g. So this is just z of 0. Okay.
You performed the...
Pardon?
You performed the integral by parts in the previous...
Right? I have not integrated by part here. I have integrated by part just when I... Here I just make a change of variable. In the integration, this is just a change of variable. Remember, phi is a dummy variable. That's a variable where you integrate over it. So instead of integrating over phi, you may integrate over phi tilde. The measure doesn't change. It's just a linear shift. It's linear.
Should there be one more integral then?
Why?
Should there be one more integral then?
No.
As an integral?
No. No, because g is fixed. G is a variable. It's a constant. It's a parameter. You don't integrate over g. Okay? So I make just a change of variable. Inside the integral. Okay? So I get an explicit expression for z of g. Z of g is z of 0. Times this exponential. Okay, and we are going to need this expression later. G of g is z of 0 times exponential of h bar over 2 g times, of course, there is a minus 1, so it's minus the Laplacian plus m squared to the power minus 1 times g. Okay, very important relation. Easy to derive if you are careful. And of course, the calculation was possible because everything is Gaussian integral. Yes?
A minute. Yes? One of the,
pardon?
Shouldn't be one of the h-bar?
No, because the h-bar was, I put the h-bar, one over h-bar, I'm sorry. Yes, yes, of course. Yes, yes, yes. You are right. I don't know why he made the change. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Okay, but now go back to this formula. So we know what g of g is, and we set z equals 0. So it means simply that the correlation function phi of x1, phi of xn, is just, well, I put the h bar to the power n in front, it's h bar to the power n, and then it's the functional derivative with respect to g at point x1 times the functional derivative of delta of g at point xn of this object. It's exponential of plus 1 over 2 h bar. This scalar product, g times the inverse of this operator, times g of x. But if you think about it, write it again in terms of position of variable, this is integral dx, integral dy, g at a point x, g at a point y, times the kernel of this object, which is just the propagator g of x minus y that we computed. Computed yesterday. Okay, and then I everything is in the exponential. You see? Yes?
I think I missed that step. But when did you really add the source term in the third line? Where did you get the source term from?
I just made the source term was added just when performing the change of variable. I start from this.
Yeah, but in the previous line you didn't have.
Yeah, you were working on.
No, here this is S of phi. But now this is S of phi minus G phi. So S of phi minus G phi can be rewritten as S of phi tilde minus this term, which doesn't depend on it. That's where I made the change of variable. OK? OK, so, and of course, this has to be set at G equals 0. Once you have computed. So now, you see easily that you have a derivative, n derivative of a function which is even in G, the exponential of quadratic form, set at G equals 0. So only when n is even, you get something non-zero. So n has to be even. Otherwise, you get zero. Now, if you just take two derivatives, delta of the g of x1 and x2, first action can give you a g of x1 minus y, g of y, plus the numerator. The second derivative have to apply to the one that fell. Otherwise, there will be a g that goes to zero. So compute exactly that. N equal 2. What you get? You get that this is delta over delta g of x2. I perform first the integral over x1 of of 1 over h bar g of x1 minus y g of y integral over y times the exponential 1 over 2 h bar integral g dx da 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 da. And if I know I perform the functional integral over the g that which are there, then I get 2g that vanishes when g equals 0. So I get, so the only term that counts in when you apply this functional derivative to this g, and then you get g of x1 minus x2. So what you get is g of x1 minus 2. And you get a 1 over h bar here. And you get a h bar squared since you had n equal 2. So you get the results we got yesterday. Now, for n equal 4, well, you have to work a bit more because you can, what you have to do is to apply twice the functional, two of the functional derivative on the g, x, g in the, inside the exponential. And the two other g to the remaining g, which is in front of the exponential that fell from the application of the first g. So that you kill the g which are in front of the exponential. And you have three ways to do that. You choose two of the four g and you apply them to the exponential. And then the two remaining, you apply them to the j times g, which fell. So you have the three possibilities. And if you work out, you found that found g of x1 minus x2, g of x3 minus x4, plus g of x1 minus x3, g of x2 minus x4, plus g of x1 minus x4, g of x2 minus x3. There's the only three ways. So you do the calculation explicitly, you have the expression, you work out, you turn a bit crank, and then you get this. So you get that the four-point function, phi of x1, phi of x4, is just the combination of the sum of this of the products of the two-point function associated to the each possibility of pairings. Of course, you are going to have an h bar squared in front of it, but this one is trivial. So in other words, if you are interested, now I use this, this notation of Feynman diagrams that you have already met in the QFT1 course. If I represent the propagator g of x1 minus x2 by a single line that joins the point x1 to the point x2, and that's the two-point function, then the correlation function involving four points, x1, x2, x3, and x4, that's a graphical way to represent this big object, is just given by this plus this, plus this. Well, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 1, 2, three, four, and one, two, three, four. Okay. And so on. So if you consider a 6-point function, then you must consider all the different ways to pair the 6 vertices. Then correlation function for n equal 6, you get the sum pairing in terms of three propagators of products of three propagators. Then it starts to grow, but you can check if I made no mistakes that then you have, I think, 15 different pairings. So it grows up. And there is an explicit formula on the number of pairings that, in fact, you can extract from that. I think that's a general exercise. So that the number of pairings for n equal 2m propagator, and I think it's factorial 2, it's factorial 2m divided by 2m over factorial n, I think. Okay. And of course, this is Wick's theorem. Derived just from somewhat elementary calculation on Gaussian integrals. Coming from just integrals. Or if you prefer the language of probability, the expectation value, expectations of Gaussian variables in the language of probability theory. So I think in probability theory, this Wick theorem has, of course, a completely different name of some mathematician. It's the same theorem for probability theory. Okay. So you see that you can derive the Wick theorem without dealing with creation and annihilation operator and the their commutation relations. Of course, that's the same result. So those two derivations are equivalent. But it illustrates, it's one of the simplest illustrations of the power of functional integral methods. Okay. Well, I think I will end up here for the free theory. And I'll start to discuss the interacting theory. But since, of course, it's a different matter, maybe it's a good time to make the break. So let's meet in 5 minutes.
Can I learn to spend that?
I see not the problems.
You know how to, I don't understand it.
Well, it's because there's one thing that automatically tells you that the palette's not curved.
Yes.
Okay.
On the bottom bar, right?
Okay.
And usually, so basically,
yes.
Anyone could use.
Yes.
When we draw this picture of the complex
okay.
time,
but like,
yes.
But the
yes.
People don't play one or the other.
It's
one. Like, I don't know.
Yes.
The
that
like this, you'd have one. And
good point.
Using the fucking.
Good point. In fact,
it's a lot better. When
if you want to,
then it's easier to like
deform this.
Like this around that.
You have to deform it in this way. Of course, if you want to keep the topology, what you can do is you deform it in this way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It goes along the time direction, but then it has to go back and then turn again. Otherwise, okay. And when you are doing that, in fact, you are performing time evolution of your quantum systems, basically from past to the future. But then you take your system and you go back in the past, but without performing integration. So you have operators here. I make something to the theory was the point you have the operator. So you back, you go
second, you have a different color
forward in time, so that's a causal evolution.
So
then times an anti-causal evolution.
For the nodes
but that's just an ordinary, unitary operator evolution. But since you go from plus to minus infinity, it's just the complex conjugate of u. So it's u dagger. And then you make this, which projects on the vacuum. You see. So in fact, when you start from this, you start from a of t1, a of t2, tau2, that's b of tau2 in the Euclidean. Okay. What you are performing is just this first integration means that you compute the time order product of A at time T1 and of B at time T2.
Okay.
Between some initial and some final states. Initial final states. But then you go back in time, which means that you divide by just the evolution operator between here and here, because you take the evolution, the matrix element of the evolution operator are complex numbers. So it's just a unitary operator. So the complex conjugate is the inverse of the operator. So you divide by that. And then you do that for a large. So you project on the vacuum. So in fact, this is the vacuum at past infinity. This is the vacuum at future infinity. Again, this is the vacuum at past infinity. And this is the vacuum at future infinity. So this is a phase. What is that? In fact, is going to rotate when the time becomes different. But you normalize that by that, and you get the correct result. So doing that, you get what's considered in QFT. Because in QFT, you consider the same operator.
You're right.
Because in fact, the vacuum at past infinity is some phase.
Syllables to represent
some exponential
the people we use.
Times the energy of the vacuum times minus infinity times the vacuum at time zero. And the same for zero at the future. Exponential IE zero times plus infinity. While there is a minus, that's not important. Times zero at time zero. So here you get the phase, and here you get the phase that cancels. So in fact, this is zero, the ordinary zero at time zero. T of A of T1, A of T2. The same vacuum states.
Yeah.
You take a reference. You take a reference time. You define the vacuum state to be the state at that time, and you normalize. And everything is consistent.
Okay.
It's a bit of a subtlety, but it's an important subtlety.
It's funny. I did my master's in lattice QCD stuff.
Yes. No, but that's called this Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. In fact.
Two-time.
Yeah, because here you have one time and then you have one time. And if you start, if you start to insert operator in the second term, then you get other correlation functions, And that's a way to get advanced and retard propagator, for instance, combining operators, the positive time operators on the negative. Okay, but that's too advanced at that stage. But that's no, that's okay. So that's how things work. Okay. Okay. So now, phi to the 4. Okay, so forget about that. I'm going to put this. Interacting phi to the 4. So now, interacting. Phi to the 4 theory. Okay. So it's a theory that is important for different respects. First, it's the simplest quantum field theory that one can study. There is no spin, there is no gauge bosons, no gauge symmetries. So it's simpler. But it's also relevant for condensed matter. Because we have seen this theory in the theory of critical phenomena, why it's important in the theory of critical phenomena. It's also important because it describes the Higgs sector in the standard model, because the Higgs is a scalar. It's a charge scalar. Well, it's a charge, but it's important. Okay. So this theory is described by the following action. So in addition to the classical action, so again, I'm just going to work in the Euclidean because I get no unpleasant factor. But we are going to add to this the term over the phi to the 4. This is it. And I'm adding a coupling constant of this form, of course. So G is called the coupling constant. Okay, and we are going to take it always positive or zero for reasons I'm going to explain in a few minutes. This factorial 4 is just for convenience in the calculation. It's convenient. For convenience, but the reason why it's convenient is a deep reason. Okay, and why phi to the 4? Why phi to the 4? That's because the field phi describes bosons. Phi describes bosons, so particles with mass m propagating in spacetime. Three bosons. And phi squared, in fact, if you work a bit about it, phi squared of x describes the number of particles at point x. Number of bosons. In fact, it's the density of bosons at point x in space-time. So at a given point, at a given time, if you compute expectation value of phi squared, you obtain something which is related to the density of bosons. It depends on the state. It's zero in the vacuum, but if you have some excited states, then you have particles. Okay? And so what does it mean a phi to the 4 term? It means that you have an interaction term that's proportional to the square of the density. So phi to the 4 describes, in fact, what's happening. You have two bosons at the same point. So it describes the two particle interactions. And it tells you, remember that this is the energy. It tells you that the energy of the system is higher if you have two particles at the same time than if you have only one. So it's a particle which, so imagine that you have two particles here and they meet at the same point, then they interact. They interact at the same point because it's a phi squared of x times phi squared of x. It's not phi squared of x times phi squared of y, which would be a non-local interaction. For instance, it could be an interaction mediated by photons. That's different. So it's a local. And since it's local, it's going to be relativistic invariant. As long as you have long distance effect, you must be very, very careful. It's local. In addition, G is positive. It means that it costs energy. This is the energy, the potential energy of the field configuration. So it means that the situation is more energetic if you have. So it means that the interaction is repulsive because the systems would prefer to have a low level, a small number of particles at the same point that higher. So it's a repulsive. Interaction. So it's a local repulsive interaction. Yes?
Didn't you say that bosons would like to remain with each other? So
no, they like to be together. If you have free bosons, if you have interacting bosons, they still it's still possible for them to be at the same place. It's different from fermions. If you have two fermions, you cannot have a local interaction between fermions because they cannot be at the same place together. For bosons, it's possible, but you may have a repulsive interaction between bosons, or may have an attractive interaction between bosons. If you have an attractive interaction between bosons, that's quite bad, because this means that the more boson you have, the more energy you gain. So you get a condensation of boson. And the system is not stable. The system, the theory prefers to create bosons at the same place, and you gain energy, energy, energy. So the ground state is not, the vacuum energy is not a state, the vacuum state is not a state where you have no bosons and then small quantum fluctuation. It's a state where you have an infinite number of bosons with an infinite negative energy. So 5-4 means that I'm considering repulsive local interaction. That's the physics of the 5-4 theory. Okay, but so of course now what we are interested in is the physics of that, both the classical and the quantum physics. So this is the Euclidean action. But of course, you can consider the theory at real time in Minkowski space, and then write the corresponding action. Remember, this is the potential energy term, and this contains the kinetic energy term, which has a derivative with respect to time, plus the potential term that contains the derivative with respect to space. So the corresponding Minkowskian, so real-time action is written as electron node, but it's going to be simply dt over d phi squared minus all the remainders. Okay. And so now, well, this classical theory is already interesting because it's a non-trivial interacting theory. The classical solution are not Plave waves anymore. Classical solution. Motion for the field. Well, you take the functional derivative of the action, you get Euler-Lagrange equation, and the Euler-Lagrange equation are obviously minus delta plus m squared of phi at a given point x, that comes from the free field. And then you have a modification, and the modification is the derivative of this respect to phi, so you get plus g over, then you get factorial 3, so it's 6 times pi cube. Okay, where delta is d over d, and in Minkowski space, for instance, in Minkowski, delta is minus d squared over dt squared plus d squared over dx, well, d over dx squared. So you have a wave equation in real time, but with a nonlinear term. So it's a nonlinear Klein-Gordon equation. Okay?
Equal to zero.
What?
That equation equal to zero on the right hand side.
Yeah, of course. It has to be equal to zero. Of course. Okay. So we have this. One wants to quantize this system of interacting bosons. Of course, you can do that. You have only started to do that using canonical formulation, but that's easy to do in using functional integral. So the main aim, of course, is to compute correlation functions of operators. What we want is to compute correlation functions, namely objects which are going to be called like expectation value of phi of x1, phi of xn, but in the interacting theory where the Vick theorem doesn't apply anymore. Okay, and these objects we can call them. Some function g is going to be correlation functions. Because it depends now on g. Well, in order to compute those objects by functional integral, we may just apply the same trick than here. You see. Now you define a functional integral. And from this, so the functional integral is going to be integral d of phi, then exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi. But now you take the interacting theory, not the, so it depends on g. Okay. And you had minus g dot phi with exactly the same notation that I had before. Okay. So now I have a generating functional which depends on g. I don't know if I had defined it in a proper way here. Okay. And let me write, that's the notation I have in the notes, let me write S of phi as F0 phi, that's the action for the free field, plus S interaction of phi, that's the result of the interaction, is of course Si of phi is just G divided by 24 times integral d d x of phi 4 of x. Okay. Okay, so how do we compute this? I want to compute this object, which is going to be the ratio of two terms, remember. Now, we know that in general, this object, phi of x1, phi of xn, is going to be given by the functional integral d phi, exponential of minus 1 of h bar, the action of the theory times product of the random fields phi of x1, phi of xn, and divided by d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi. Okay? That's what we want to compute by functional integral. But now both the numerator and the denominator depend on g, the coupling constant. So the calculation is more complicated. And so how can we proceed? Well, it's straightforward. Well, let's consider, I just have not to get lost in my calculation. Let's consider the general numerator. Of course, you see that the denominator is just a special case of the numerator where you have no phi, so that's n equals zero. So let's consider that. The numerator can be written as integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar, and of course I can decompose s into the free action plus the interaction action, so I get s0 of phi, then I have exponential of minus 1 over h bar the interacting time, so that's g over factorial 4 phi 4 of x. And then I have some phi, and in fact, in order to be not mixed in the notes and in my usual lectures, I label them by position z, by the name z. So the z's, these I are going to be the external positions variable, because you don't integrate over them. While here, you see, you integrate over x. Okay? And then you have phi of z1, phi of zn. Okay, so the numerator is this. And let us divide it by this, where I had no g, so let me divide this by exponential integral d of phi, exponential minus 1 over h bar s0 of phi, and multiply by this same integral, which turns out to be just z0. So z0 is the generating function of the free theory at g equals zero. It's just this plain Gaussian integral. Well, the reason to do that is that if I put a z0 here, there will be a z0 on the numerator and a z0 on the denominator. So you don't care. They will change. It's just a change of normalization of the integral. And I'm interested into this object, this big object. And well, that's so here, that's exactly the same thing that has what has been done in QFT1. you expand the integral. So this exponential of minus 1 over h bar g divided by factorial 4 integral d d of x by x by 4 of x. You expand the exponential, that's sum over k from 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial k minus 1 over h bar to the power k. There is a with a factorial 4. So it, in fact, it's going to be 1 over factorial k minus g divided by h bar factorial 4 to the power k times k times this integral. Yes?
So C0 is for the free theory, right?
Yes.
So why when we multiply by C0 and we divide by...
You are going to see in a minute why you do that. For the moment, I have not done anything. We'll see. Then, so let us, I expand that. So of course you have k times the power of this integral. So k times the power of this integral may be written as an integral over k x's. So we can write this integral over k variables of dd of x1, dd of x k times phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk. Okay. Just a straightforward expansion. Now we are going to make something which seems obvious, but is in fact not that obvious. We invert two infinite sums. We invert the functional measure of a phi and the sum of a k. Here you have an integral of a d phi, so some infinite sum over all the possible value of the phi phi. And here you have a sum of a k inside that. So let's invert them. Then we get for this numerator here, this ratio here, we get sum over k from 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial k minus g to the power k minus g divided by h bar factorial 4 to the power k. And then we have the integral over dd of x1 dd of xk. And then we have a functional integral with the action of the free theory of products of phi 4 at the point x1 to xk and products of phi at the point z1, zn, divided by the same functional integral without any of those phi. So what we get is just the expectation value of the products of phi of z1, phi of zn, times phi 4 of x1, phi 4 of xk. But the expectation value given by a functional integral where the action is the free theory. So we get the expectation value for the free theory, which is labeled by 0. So that's an expectation value. For the free theory, the interaction is there. And so dealing with the, so you see that the computing some kind of expectation value for the interacting theory amounts to sum to expand in series and have a product of term more complicated. But you can compute with the free theory. Okay? So this is for this numerator. So let's call this, big object Z. Well, in my notes, it's denoted Z with a bar of Z1 Zn. Okay, this object, which is this. Now on the denominator, we get the same thing with no Z's. So what we get is that this is just Z bar of Z1 Zn, and that's an n-point correlation function, so we can call this Zn. Divided by Z bar 0, which depends on no point, but which depends on G. So the expectation value in the interacting theory is just the ratio of two big series that depends on G. Yes? Well, the Z naught in the numerator is cancelled by the Z naught in the denominator. It's just a normalization. Okay. So we get that this is equal to this. And okay. So what we have to compute are those objects. You know, this infinite sum of series of integrals of products. So now, of course, since we are dealing with this, with the free theory, the trick is to use Wick's theorem, which is the basis of any reasonable perturbation expansion. Yes?
So this expectation value is going to be for the vacuum interaction.
Yes, that's the object I have defined above for the free theory.
But is it going to be for the interaction vacuum instead of?
No, here it's for the free theory. Oh. So this corresponds to the vacuum of the free theory. While this, the things we want to compute here, correspond to expectation value of products of the operator I of the n in the vacuum of the interacting theory. And of course, the vacuum of the interacting theory is a quantum state, which is very different from the vacuum of the free theory. But you see that expectation value of this in the vacuum of the interacting theory may be expressed in terms of ratios of series of integrals involving expectation value of the products of operator in the vacuum of the free theory. So that's the basis of perturbation theory. So this is theory. Okay. And so then, of course, we use Wick's theorem because we can express this as a sum over pairings of all those fields. Products of propagator. So you see these terms, for instance, in these terms, we have n plus 2k fields phi. So this can be expressed as a sum our parents. Of course, pairings, there are pairings if this is, I'm sorry, it's not 2k, it's 4k. So there are pairings only if n equal to m is even. Okay. And so you can express these terms as the sum over pairings of products of propagator with some points y, whether y can be these heights or x, let's call it a, where the indices I goes from 1 to n equal to m, and a goes from 1 to k. But in fact, there are four x's, but each x's are grouped by group of four where they are equal. Okay? And then you integrate over the x's. All the kx. So you get a sum of a pairings of a big integral. You get a sum of a pairings of times integrals of products of propagators. Now, using the representation in terms of diagrams of operators, you can represent this object as diagrams. And I'm going to give the examples, but you have seen already examples of Feynman diagram in the previous courses. So those diagrams are the famous Feynman diagrams. And the integral of these products of propagator, which are given by the diagrams, are the famous Feynman integrals. So I have about 5 minutes, more or less. So, well, the best is just to give some examples. So, what are what's called the Feynman rules? For this theory, you have products of propagators. So, a propagator is just the object we have defined in the free theory. Like this object. You have two vertices, which can be y1 and y2. And remember, the y can be z's or x's. And if there is a propagator between those 2 points, you represent it by a factor g. So, and you associate g of y1 minus y2, which is the propagator we have calculated yesterday. But now, so you have an integral of products of propagators. You have a diagram. But now you see the phis are grouped by 4. So each, so if you have an x, here x, 4 phi have to be attached to this x. So there are 4 propagators that end up, well, you have propagators. And 4 endpoints of propagator, 4 ends of propagator end up there. So you have a vertex here, where you have some propagator here. And for each vertex, 4 endpoints of propagator have to be attached to this vertex. Okay? So this is called a vertex. Interaction vertex of the theory. And of course, to each vertex comes a factor minus g over h bar factorial 4. So we are going to put a factor minus g, minus the coupling constant associated to this vertex. They are going to be h bar and they are going to be factorial 4, but I'm going to treat them a bit differently. Okay, do not forget. The h bar, the one over factorial k, and the one over factorial 4. Going to discuss that later. Okay. And of course, the propagator is h bar. Phi phi is a h bar times this. Okay, so these are the Feynman rules. And of course, then you have to integrate over the x's, which are called the positions of the internal vertices. Why internal? Because those are vertices you integrate over. But you must remember that you have also phi z's, which are external fixed vertices. So you have internal vertices, and you have external vertices, which are labeled by the z, z1 to zn, and only one propagator can be attached to each of those z, because there is only one phi, okay? And the position is fixed. Z is fixed. So you have some propagators, and in fact, how many propagators may you have? You may have only m plus 2k propagators. M plus 2k propagators, because each propagator has two endpoints. That's a fundamental theorem of topology. A segment has two endpoints. And you have k interaction vertices and n external vertices. Okay? So that's the number of objects you have to consider. And then you have to, do the combinatorics. Count all the diagrams, all the objects you can construct by pairing those objects by propagators. And to each pairing, to each diagram, will be associated a Feynman integral. Okay, so let me give examples, and I'm just going to... So I'm first going to consider the examples where n equals 0. I won't have time to do more. So n equals 0 means you have no external vertices. So in fact, what we are going to expand is what's happening in this denominator. So k equals 0 propagator is trivial. You have no k vertex, you have no external vertex, you have no everything. So k equals 0 means you have no g, you have no h. In fact, what you are doing, you are expanding the first term here of the exponential. It's 1, so it gives 1. The number 1. It's exponential of 0. Now, consider a case where you have k equal 1. You have one vertex, one internal vertex. So you have one vertex here at a position x1, and you are computing expectation value of 5-4 of x in the interacting theory. So you have a vertex with 4 external legs, if you want, 4 legs, and you have to join propagators. Well, you have 3 ways to do that. You have this, this, and you have this. So you have 3 Feynman diagrams. But of course, those 3 Feynman diagrams gives exactly, combinatorically, they are the same. So this is the same. Diagram that I'm going to draw like that. There are differences if you consider that this is a first leg, this is second leg, this is third leg, and this is 4 legs. Then they are different. But if you forget about the fact that the legs are labeled, and here they are not labeled, then it's the same diagram. Okay, so what is the amplitude of this diagram? Well, you have a point x. So you have a propagator that goes from x to x. So you get just g of 0 squared, because you have 2 propagators with the product of those 2 propagators. Then you have to integrate over the position of the vertex. 0 is x minus x. So you get a term which is the volume of spacetime. It's quite natural. Okay, and then what do you have? You have a mind. So now let's count the edge bar. K equal 1, so you have 1 edge bar. So you get a minus g. So you get a minus g. You have a 1 over edge bar per vertex, but you have an edge bar per propagator. So you get edge bar. Okay, so it's a quantum correction. And then, what about the factorial? K equal 1, so this is 1, but you have a 1 over factorial 4. But you have 3 different pairings, so you get a factor of 3. Which is, of course, 1 over 8. So the amplitude, the term with the amplitude associated to this diagram is this integral, which in that case is easy to compute, a factor h bar, a minus g, because there is 1 vertex, and a combinatorial factor, which is called the symmetry factor. Okay. Yes?
What are the other factors of H-bar?
Pardon? Where?
The other factors of H-bar.
Where? I'm sorry. You ask whether there are some other one?
Yeah, where did the other factors of H-bar come from? So H-bar came to the denominator, or to the numerator.
No, because this H-bar is 1 over h bar, coming from this, times h bar squared. Because phi phi, remember, phi of x1, phi of y, it's h bar g of x minus y. G of x minus, if g of x minus y is just the integral dk over 2 pi k, E I k x minus y over k squared plus m squared. So I consider that g of k is just an integral with no h bar factor. It's a propagator of the series for h bar equal 1, and the h bar is in front. So that this is really an integral. There are no physical, well, there is a mass, but apart from the mass, there are no quantum parameters. Hence, we get h bar here. Yes.
So g of zero has a UV divergence, right?
Of course, of course. G of zero, I'm gonna write it. G of zero is integral d dk, 2 pi to the power d, 1 over k squared plus m squared. So this is infinite if the dimension is larger or equal to 2. And in fact, I've discussed that at length last time. So I'm cheating at it. Okay, so that's an ultraviolet divergence. Okay. So at the moment, let's just close our eyes on it. We'll deal that later. That's a number here. Well, this number is infinite, but okay. If you don't like that, just define the theory on a lattice. Of course, all those functional calculation rules and combinatorics rules do not depend on the exact form of the action. They do not depend on whether space is continuous or discretized. You have an integral over x, but integrals can mean the sum of the position, sum of the vertices of the lattice. Okay. So on a lattice, that's OK. This is OK. So in other words, if you introduce an ultraviolet short distance regularization, all the rule applies.
Okay. Does it stay Lorentz invariant?
Pardon?
Does it stay Lorentz invariant if you're on the lattice? Or?
It's not. You mean whether it's Lorentz invariant?
Yeah.
It's not Lorentz invariant. It's just invariant on a cubic transformation. But that's the same problem for the free theory. You lose something. As soon as you introduce an ultraviolet regularization, you lose some properties of the quantum theory where locality is very important. So on a lattice, you lose Lorentz invariance. You can introduce other regularization. I will allude to that later, where you don't lose Lorentz invariance, but then you lose something else. Usually you lose unitarity or causality or both. So you have to check that you recover locality, causality, Lorentz invariance when you take the continuum limit. Okay, but the combinatorics doesn't depend on those constraints. Combinatorics is combinatorics of integrals and Taylor expansions. Okay. So, well, I end up here. The next lecture is going to be soon. So of course, so G0 is infinite, as we said. This factor is, in fact, integral d dx is the volume of space-time, so it's also infinite. So you may be worried about that. But again, define a theory in a box of size L with periodic boundary condition, and everything is fine. This formulation doesn't is independent of the fact you integrate over infinite space or on a cylinder or something else. So introducing what's called an infrared regulator cures that. So as far as the combinatorics is concerned, and that's what we are going to do in the next lecture, we don't have to care about neither ultraviolet divergences nor what's called infrared divergences. Okay, so thank you.